Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast, where you get to learn everything you want to know about addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, co-founder of Kansas City Recovery, life coach, and recovering alcoholic. To learn more about me, you can listen to episode zero on your podcast app or find us on the web at addictionunlimited.com. A party guy in high school and hooked from the first drink. He worked in public relations in the NBA for the Charlotte Hornets and now in a career in television news, as well as being a sports guy for ESPN. And addiction and recovery were part of it all. Hello, my friend. Welcome back to another episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast. I'm your coach, Angela Pugh. We have so many great guests on this show, and today's guest is probably in my top five favorite interviews. Not only because there's a ton of laughing, but also because this is a true testament to the power of recovery and how, when done well, you embrace a freedom you never knew possible. From the insanity of addiction to the power of recovery and utilizing all the tools for huge transitions, you won't want to miss this one. Let's welcome Pete Sousa. Okay, Pete, thank you so much for coming on and doing this show with me. I'm super excited to hear your story and your career. Let's start with just tell everybody who you are and what you do.
Well, the first thing, I mean, because you got me thinking about it, I'm Pete, I'm an alcoholic. That's Amen. The first thing. My sobriety date is November 7th, 2011. And I love opportunities to talk about my story, because everything that I am today, is everything positive, is because of recovery from addiction. And right now, I have a podcast about recovery called The Payoff with Pete: Stories of Sobriety. I call football and basketball and baseball for ESPN, and I anchor news in Central Texas, where I live in Waco. So I stay busy. My phone wouldn't ring at the end of my addiction. And as you can relate, I'm sure, Angela, after a while, it does start to ring again, whether it's job opportunities or people that, are connected with you now through this thing. It's a gift.
Yeah, it is, for sure. I so love that you introduced yourself that way too, because it makes my heart feel a little warm and fuzzy going back to the rooms, and just the standard introduction. Like, it's so simple and it's such a basic foundational piece, but has definitely, I feel like, gotten more confusing in recent years with so much different terminology and different paths to recovery. And I love different paths to recovery.
Me too.
At the same time, I'm so grateful that when I got sober, it was so simple, because I could have way overcomplicated it. I could have overthought every single piece of the process. And I probably would have stayed drunk another 5 years, just battling with those things. Like, what do I call myself? Where do I go? I don't like every piece of this program. Maybe I should go somewhere else. Maybe this isn't the right fit. That would have kept me drunk way longer.
Yes, 100%. And I do think the magic of my story, and it sounds like yours too, is the simplicity of it. Like,
yeah.
And I complicated it for so long, and that kept me drunk for so long. But I was a sick guy.
Yeah. Well, we all were.
Yeah.
We just hope to get a little better in the journey.
Yeah.
So when did you know that addiction was a problem for you? Like, when did you realize, like, oh shit, I may be in a situation that requires additional help, right? Like, I'm not just going to be able to figure it out on my own.
My first big consequence was I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and I came into my own somewhat playing football in high school. And I got recruited. I got a scholarship to play football. I was playing my senior year, I was drinking a lot, taking a lot of pills that weren't mine, smoking whatever I'd get my hands on. And I was also just running hard, working out a lot, playing sports. But really, I was the second half of my senior year, like in high school, January to, let's say, May, I was just a drug addict. And I had to play in a football all-star game, and I was playing in this all-star game, and I had to get a physical. And they were giving me a physical, and the doctor said, hey, your heart's beating funny. We need to send you to a cardiologist before we can clear you to play in this game. And I went to see the cardiologist, and he was like, you have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And he's like, now this could have happened one of two ways. It could be a viral situation, and a cardiologist could pick this apart, but this is what I understood it as. You know, this is could be a viral situation where you have a virus. The virus goes away. Your body is so accustomed to fighting the virus that it attacks your organs and or your heart. Or another way could have been, you know, abuse of alcohol and drugs coupled with this viral thing. And I was like, well, you know, it's not alcohol and drugs for me, you know, like, so it's got to be the virus. And I was 18 years old. And in the back of my mind, here was all I wanted to do was play college football previously. But now all I wanted to do was drink and use drugs. That's all I wanted to do. And, you know, your heart is a pretty essential part of the whole deal.
Kind of important.
So I was willing to put that, my risk my life, any shot at a career or whatever. I wanted to keep drinking and using, so much so that I was like, hey, this is not, the problem must have been viral. And I remember thinking to myself, like, wow, this is major. I mean, I buried it and used for another 15 years, I guess. But that was the moment I thought, wow, something's wrong with me here. And I have no control over it. And it's just it seemed like business as usual to me, because I became so good at stuffing any kind of emotions or second guessing about my addiction. But that was a pretty huge part of, I remember thinking, wow, the wheels might be coming off here.
So to clarify, when you said to the doctor, like, oh, it's not alcohol and drugs, did you really believe that?
No.
Or were you lying? Okay.
No, I knew I was lying.
Okay.
I knew right away. I knew exactly how it, I knew 100% how I had ended up with this way. Now, how much of a virus was a part of it, I don't know. But I knew that I was an 18-year-old kid who had really ventured into, like, you know, hard drugs as far as, like, you know, any kind of pills, you know, prescription. I was down in those nonstop. I hadn't even discovered cocaine yet, but I was taking uppers, downers, you know, what if you gave it to me and put it in my hand, I would take it and then ask you what it was, you know?
Yeah. I remember I knew a bunch of people like that when I lived in Los Angeles that literally would just take anything without a second thought. And I am a good old fashioned alcoholic, right? I never got into drugs. It wasn't my thing. Like, I smoked pot a little bit, like if other people were doing it, but it wasn't my thing. I didn't love it. It made me weird. It made me paranoid. Like, it just wasn't enjoyable. You know, I'm just a drunk. And one time when I was young, I took ecstasy with my friends. They had this brilliant idea. And I was like, okay, I take the thing. And my girlfriend immediately is like, oh, by the way, you're not supposed to drink when you take this. And I'm like, what the F? Like, why would you, have you met me? Why would you give me something that I can't drink? Like, that's a terrible idea, you know? So, okay, it was fine. We get through the night, we go out, the whole thing, it's fine. It did not touch the fun I would have had I been drinking, but it wasn't terrible. But here was the thing. We got home at the end of the night and it's time to go to sleep. Well, I was ready to go to sleep, but the ecstasy was not ready to go to sleep. So it was just laying there, like tossing and turning and uncomfortable, right? Because I'm ready to go to bed. The ecstasy wants to stay up. Like, it was still partying.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, there was nothing I could do. And the powerlessness that I felt in that moment, like, I had this realization that, like, oh, damn, when you take something, all bets are off.
Yeah,
right.
You don't know,
like, once it's in you, you don't know what's going to happen. And I was not a fan of that at all. So
you mentioned,
I knew
offline. So you like control.
Oh my God, are you kidding me?
Yeah,
only myself. I'm not controlling, like, with people or anything like that. But yes, with, like, myself and my surroundings, my well-being, yes, that will be fully dependent on me.
Yes.
Sure. But yeah, that was my one experience with drugs where I was just like, absolutely not. It'll never happen again because you have no idea what's going to happen. And drinking, although, you know, I probably only did this once ever in my life, but drinking, like you can back up your drunk. You can stop drinking. You can drink water. You can get something to eat. Like you still have some power even in that, right? But not with drugs. It's like once it's in you, it's game on.
It's gone.
Yeah.
Literally the horse has left the barn and anything is possible a lot of times because today now with what young people are taking, now it's a roll of the dice for your life. I mean, and it was for me a lot of times too. I was addicted to drugs and alcohol. I mean, alcohol was my baseline, like just a drunk, you know, it's all throughout my family, on my dad's side. But now I'm very grateful that I wasn't active during this period, because I would have taken something that probably would have killed me, because there wasn't a lot of discretion going on as far as where I was getting it and what I was taking.
Yeah, I can so relate to that too. I had that feeling about drugs also where I feel like I'm so compulsive, right? And with drinking even, I mean, the amount that I drank on a daily basis was absurd. And if I would have gotten into drugs, right, and would have been at that level, I'm like, there's no way I ever would have survived that. Like, I'm sure I would have just taken drugs until I died. It would have been a very short story, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's kind of what I did with drinking anyway.
I know all about, like that's the drinking and the round the clock, and it's just, it's painful. And yeah, with me, the drugs, I think, expedited my recovery, but they could have killed me first.
Right.
Without question.
Right.
But for the grace of God.
When you were thinking about getting sober, like what were some of your fears?
Oh, great. That's a great question. It's the biggest mind fuck of all times. Alcohol and drugs are. I really believed without a doubt that I would not be able to big relationships with the opposite sex was a huge thing. Alcohol had been a conduit to that and for that my entire existence as far as relationships were concerned. Without that, I felt like I wouldn't be able, I would never meet anyone, let alone somebody I would be with forever. I thought people, I wouldn't have fun again. That you could probably put that almost ahead of the female aspect. Like my life will not be fun. It will no longer be fun. I drank when I did everything. So now I can't do anything.
And it sounds crazy after you've been sober for a while and you look back, you're like, God, why did I think that? But I'm sure you can relate to this, as I'm sure my listeners will relate to this. If that is all you ever did to have fun, it's hard to imagine doing it any differently.
Yes. And I'm not a doctor, but you're infected. Your brain is infected. It's a toxic wasteland. I mean, if you're drinking alcohol all the time, if you're putting drugs in your body all the time, you are not thinking clearly, and it's going to take a while before you do. And it's going to probably take a lot of help before you can even think straight. And so not thinking straight, you know, I'm not going to have fun. I'm never going to have relationships. I'm not going to be, you know, cool, whatever that is. I'm not going to be a part of, you know, alcohol was, it enabled me to connect with people, as far as I was concerned. And I'm very happy to say, like, I'm here to tell everyone that's listening, like, that was all total bullshit. And it wasn't easy to get to a part where I really, truly discovered that it was. I did a lot of work to get there, but it was a total lie. And the lie, too, that your ego tells you that you're cool, that you're going to cool places, cool parties, you know, really. I'm going here, I'm going there. It's like, dude. It's not, you're not cool. Like, I mean, maybe you are, whatever, but when you're an active addiction and you're finally in free fall, there's nothing cool about that.
Nothing cool. Now, listen, I also was very cool. And, you know, I mean, I was a bartender, you know, Hollywood, mm-hmm. Beverly Hills, like I was going to all the right parties with the right people, like living the life that most people kind of would dream about, you know.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And there were some years that it was actually really fun.
Yes.
But you know, once you cross, there's a certain threshold that I crossed much later because I didn't even start drinking until I was 20 when I started working in bars, right? I didn't drink as a younger person. So my progression was slower, but once it got ugly, it was a very short journey from my drinking getting really dark to sobriety. Like I couldn't have lived like that very long. But even the times that were fun, so to speak, like it wasn't that fun. It was very lonely, right? Because I didn't have true connections. And you mentioned this a few minutes ago. And like, that's how you connected with people. Like that was the method of bonding, you know, and creating friendships and whatever. But it was also surface level. So even looking back now, it's like, I did think I was really cool, but it was so empty.
Yeah, it was empty. That's a word I was going to use. The connections were empty. And then it became an obsession to party when that's like really, I think when I can almost see myself, you know, you're partying, you're at a club, you're in New York. So it's open till 4. And I can remember, you know, having drugs, having alcohol, having like this cool environment and looking at my watch and being like, oh my gosh, we have 4 more hours left or 3. So excited and thinking like, it can't get any better than this. And even like to hyper-focus on that as being so much fun, that's when you know you're in trouble, because then it becomes, then it really becomes, what is it? God, what do they call it? Delusions of grandeur, maybe? No, yeah. That's not it. That's not it. But it's when you think back to something and you romanticize about how fun it was. So every time you drink, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to get to that point. And it never happens like that again. Right. You know, like, you have this idea in your head, like every time you're going to get drunk, you're going to reach this incredible plateau. And it just doesn't work like that.
No, it certainly doesn't. And it's such a toxic relationship, you know, like even what you're talking about, like it's such a liar, you know, like it really does kind of reel you in and convince you that it's this fantastic thing and that you're having fun and you are cool. And really, it's just trapping you. You know?
It really is. It's very much trapping you. And like you talked about it, you know, I worked in the bar business a little bit when I was in college and a little bit after. And that for me was another thing too. Like if I was, you know, going the speed limit before that with alcohol and drugs, like that just took me into the red. I mean, I was in everything about that environment. For an alcoholic, you know, some people can do it. Normal people right. can do it, whatever. And it's a job and it's fun. For me, it was a lifestyle.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. It didn't enable me to do anything productive. And really, it was just the fast track to really messing myself up internally and externally.
Yeah, no doubt. It skewed my thoughts about what drinking was and how the world drank, right? Because once I was in bars, like everybody drank every day.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I legit thought that was normal. I thought yeah. everybody drank every day because it was my lifestyle, right? That's all I saw. And I remember, it's so funny saying this now, but I remember years ago, I don't know, 25 years ago, probably, I remember hearing Donald Trump, of all people, on an interview, and he said he had never had a drink of alcohol. And I remember being so baffled by that. I'm like, what? Like, yeah, how do you go your life? I didn't know anybody that never yeah. had a drink of alcohol. That was such a foreign concept.
And the thing about people like that, like, you know, he was always out and about. So same as you, I would be like, wow, how do you go out and about and not drink?
Right.
Like, and when you get sober, yeah. It's amazing. You find out that that's another lie, that some people just don't drink at all. Some people have a drink. More often than not, people don't drink, which is like a total shocker, yeah. You know, like don't drink like I drink for sure. But yeah, that's so true. And then you find yourself going in that world where you're in that lifestyle with bartending and working in bars. And then those are the people you gravitate to outside of work. So then it's a total cycle.
Yeah. A very unhealthy cycle in my case. Yeah. Okay. So what was your rock bottom? And I don't want to say rock bottom moment because I had a rock bottom moment, but I feel like my rock bottom honestly was like 2 to 3 years in the making. Yes. You know what I mean? So what was your rock bottom leading up to actually quitting?
I think, you know, there were a couple, like you said, and there was an elongated period. I think a couple things that stick out. I had, I was living in North Carolina, and I was like, really, I somehow was still finding job opportunities, and I had started to do stuff that I loved. I was starting to do sports on the radio, for an NBA team, and I was getting drunk and going to work drunk. I was using and going to work after using. I got a DUI, and it was not my first. And, you know, I continued to go to work and continue to drink. And I just had no clue how bad it was. Everybody else around me knew, and I had no idea. And then it came to the point where I'm in my early 30s, and I had to move back home and live with my parents. After college, I had, like, really gotten some extremely awesome opportunities, and for a while, I would stick around, but then I'd burn it down, you know, and it would go from one to the next. And, you know, I was in my early 30s, and I was living at home with my parents. And I was like, if I had $10 to go to the bar, like the walk to the corner bar, or if there were, like, you know, some drugs I could get my hands on, like, that was like an incredible day. I thought, you know, I really thought that that was a good day. And then I went to a buddy of mine who I grew up with. His name's Murph. I talk to him all the time. He has now gotten sober. He had a pretty good life. He did a nice job of keeping it together before he got sober. And he had a nice house, and he had a nice party that was happening. So he had me over to his house. I kind of talked my way back into his life because he was one of those people that had cut me off, and he hadn't seen me in a while. And I show up at this party, and I'm dating this woman that. The people that we end up dating, right? Like sometimes when we're, right?
Listen, so, that's a whole other episode that should be labeled like shame and embarrassment, and I need my own recovery program for my dating choices.
So, exactly. So anyways, I show up at his house and it was just a disaster. I was like on like, I don't even know what, and I was drinking a lot, and I didn't have the uppers to take me where I needed to go. So I was like, yeah, he would tell a story better than I could because I barely remember it. But bottom line is I was like a zombie. I broke up with the girl when I was there. We fought. He threw us out. When we were leaving, we backed into a ditch that was like – so the car was like stuck going up like this, you know. And he was like, you guys got to get out of here. We called a cab to leave. The next day I showed up, a tow truck pulled the car out of the ditch. And I remember walking over to the side of his house with him. And I remember I said, do you think you can keep this between us? And he was like, he just was like, dude, you're not, he was like, and I remember he told me, this is how stupid I was. He told me, yeah, but it was after he told me, hey, dude, like, you're going to have to like, you're just not the person I knew. You know, you used to be this guy who had a positive light coming from him. Now it's just, and, you know, that was the end really for me. I had another month run after that, but that's when other people started to get involved. Like family was like aggressively involved. And, I'll tell you the last part of the story, cause it kind of goes into, you know, getting sober. I was going to AA meetings and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop drinking. I was going to AA meetings in the morning and I was drinking at night or whatever. And I was lying about my day count. And I asked this guy to be my temporary sponsor, and he took me to dinner. And I thought we were going to go to a meeting, but he picked me up and he took me to dinner. And I, again, was taking all kinds of stuff. So now I got to sit across from this guy for like, I don't know how many hours. And he just said to me, Angela, he was like, you need to go to rehab. Like, he was like, that's what I did. And yeah, that was the moment for me where I was like, I decided, like, or God decided for me or whatever. It was like the window had opened up, like the last window for me. And I just kind of rolled through to the other side. And my life has been totally different since that, you know, but a lot of shit. But that's, you know, kind of a one way to try to summarize it.
The word that was standing out to me as you were telling that story is unmanageability.
Yeah.
Right. Which I feel like I didn't understand unmanageability really until a few years, maybe into my sobriety. Like I could look at my life and go, oh yeah, it's unmanageable. But I didn't recognize all of the ways it was unmanageable, right? Like just with the chaos and drama. And, you know, for some people that chaos and drama can be in relationships. For other people, it's financial. For me, it was always financial stuff, right? Because I don't like to pay bills and I could have a ton of money, right? And I just wouldn't pay my shit because I like my money in my account more than I like it in the cable company's account, you know? And I would just put it off and be like, F them, I'm not paying. And then everything gets turned off and it's the scramble, right? It's the rushing around and paying. And that was like my drama and chaos was that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But
all of those things are unmanageability from the people we pick to hang out with romantically or friendships, either way, right? To the situations we're involved, to the chaos we take to our friends, like you're talking about this chaos at his party. Like it's all just unfreaking manageable.
Yeah. And you said it like the way you spoke about that, like, and it's to know that like, it's no longer like that is a relief to that. Wow. Like that. I don't live like that anymore. It's an amazing relief. Like life is not perfect, right? Like,
sure.
I mean, shit comes up and sometimes I'll deal with it the wrong way. More often than not now though, it doesn't come up as much. And when it does, I deal with it the right way. Yeah. And that's the exact opposite of how life was before. So that's like, just a breath of fresh air and a weight off my shoulders just when you say that about the unmanageability.
Yeah. So how did sobriety affect your career? You talked about your career a little bit. You've had a really incredible career that on paper sounds really exciting. I'm sure to live it was really exciting.
Yeah.
But how did your sobriety change you professionally or even how you show up in your career?
It changed my level of gratitude and my level of humility. You know, when I got sober, I went to rehab. After I went to rehab, I lived in a recovery house. In the recovery house, you know, I had worked in the NBA doing PR and radio, but I go to this recovery house and you have to get a job. And I ended up working at a Kentucky Fried Chicken. And it was the last thing I wanted to do. I thought I was like too good to do it.
Of course.
Which I was not. and I learned how to be accountable at a Kentucky Fried Chicken. I mean, there were other ways I learned to be accountable, but early in my recovery, I learned about showing up on time, learning new things. You know, I really stopped learning anything. And it enabled me to understand what a hard job really is. And like, and also like that stuff is not as easy as we think it is in a sense. Like when I got there, I didn't know how to work the register. I was terrified of a long line. You know, they put me at the drive-through. It's cold outside. You're ducking in, you're ducking out. The change you're giving out is wrong. People are freaking out. Like, there's a lot that went wrong, you know? And I think when I kind of recalibrated and got back into like my chosen profession, you know, got into broadcasting, I approached life and everything else from a totally different lens. You know, I started to do TV news and you have to read off a teleprompter and I'm dyslexic and this was in sobriety and I was terrible at it. But like the whole time, I mean, I always tell the story, you know, I would be like at a Chick-fil-A and people would recognize me and they wouldn't come up and say hello. I could tell they were like, that's the guy that's terrible on the news, you know? and I mean, that shit really happened for like at least like the better part of 6 months to a year. And then they accepted me. And then, cause I got better. And you know, the whole time I was going to AA, I was talking to people about what was going on with me. And I just like went through all this hard stuff because I knew I would get through it. And every opportunity that's been presented to me since then has been because of my recovery and not just because I'm sober. It's because like we talked about, there's just a way I go about things now that's so much different. I really appreciate opportunities. They're opportunities. I appreciate being a part of things. I appreciate being included. And sobriety and the things I've been through is now too, like I'll do, you know, I'm calling college basketball games now. It's the middle of the basketball season and I was doing a game recently where a lot of stuff just went sideways at West Virginia. It was a technical stuff that nobody was really responsible for, as I was concerned. You know, like the gremlins got in, you know, and right. And I was able to stay calm and cool, and we got through it. And nobody knew, and the ship got righted, and I just don't think I would have handled that the same way years ago, even 4 years ago or 3 years ago. And it's not of me to respond that way. So it's all you guys. It's people in recovery that have been doing this with me the whole time. And, you know, and after something like that, I call a mentor of mine, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a sober person, but I tell him how I got through it. And he talks to me about how I did and what to do next time. And that would never have happened before. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a whole different thought process.
A couple of things that you touched on: willingness, number one, right? Like, you have to be willing to do all those things. You had to be willing to get the job at KFC, you know, and then the ego stuff too, which I feel like is a piece. Like, these are little 12-step golden nuggets, you know, that I feel like you don't necessarily get anywhere else. And I had a sponsor who was really hard on me in male, and I loved him for that, because that's how I function, right? I can't have somebody like soft and flowery and wanting to be kind. Like, I need to know what the fuck is up and what do I need to do? Like, give it to me, you know, like, yeah. I'm ready to do this thing. Uh-huh. And, but it's those little foundational pieces that are so important that I don't know I would have learned anywhere else, right? Like, I wouldn't have either. Yeah. The humility in what you're talking about, and really being able to put your ego on the back burner and get that job and go to a recovery house. I own men's sober living houses, and I'm in these conversations all the time with my guys, you know, but the willingness, the humility in that, those are things that are so freaking important.
And that has the willingness to go to that recovery house. You mentioned it. So I'll expand. Like, you know, if you go to a rehab like I went to, by the time you're there for 2 weeks, everybody's politicking and trying to get out of going to a long-term recovery place. That's all it is.
Yes.
Part of that politicking and bullshitting. And finally, one day I was just like, I'll go. Like, where do you guys want me to go? Like, they were like, dude, you don't have a job. You've got like a bad relationship on the outside that's just waiting to rear its ugly head again. You don't have a place to live. Like, what? Like, and you're clearly like, in the infinite stages of this whole recovery thing, like, you should go here. And a guy said something to me, a guy who I don't think is sober today. And that's a lot of times how it works. He was then. Yeah. He said, it's a couple months for the rest of your life. And that's the truest statement that has ever been spoken to me. I can tell you that foundation I built there, because I don't know that I would have stayed sober had I gone home or just gone back to whatever I was. I don't even, there's nothing to go back to. So, yeah, that was a major part of my recovery, like a major part, to be willing to take suggestions. Right. And you said willingness. I mean, you said it. That is the word, right? And those recovery houses are, for me, it was essential. And it really, I was humbled in those houses. You know, if I didn't go, the job at KFC, like, my money went into, and they called it an escrow account. I'm working at KFC and I got money in an escrow account. That didn't make sense to me, but that's the terminology we used. So I never had any money. One time I went to a meeting and I left the meeting early, and a guy who was running one of the houses saw me leave early. So instead of getting $50 for the week, I got $20. And I remember he was like, do you smoke? And I was like, no. And he's like, you can make it last. I remember thinking like, oh man, you know? But all that stuff, I still lean on those messages today. That made me who I am, and that made me enable to pack stuff into the stream of life today.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. I know my poor guys, like, they have to feel like my eyes are always on them, and they're not, right? But when you're so embedded in a community, like, I remember a couple of years ago, I was in Dallas. And I'm in Dallas, and one of my friends from my home group calls me because one of the guys at Sober Living, they had people over for a football game or something, right? And they barbecued, and they had people over, and there were girls there. And there was a girl there who had just relapsed, right? So my buddy from my home group is calling me because he saw pictures on Facebook of this girl in the living room at my sober house. And my buddy's calling me going, hey, Angela, I just want to give you a heads up. Like, so-and-so is at your sober living right now. And she is not sober. And I was like, what? So I'm calling from Dallas, calling my house leader. Like, dude, what's going on right now? I know this chick is your friend. I respect that. But I don't think she's in the right place right now. Like, somebody who is relapse in relapse mode does not belong sitting at the sober living, pictures on Facebook, you know.
How many houses do you have?
I have two houses.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't grow it any bigger than that because I have two other businesses, you know what I mean? And I have really incredible, healthy sober living, and they're so amazing. And if I grew it any bigger, I wouldn't be able to maintain that culture. Like, it would just be impossible. So I'll stay at two. I love it. It's a passion project for sure.
Oh my God. It's what you're doing is unbelievable. Like, doing, I think you doing this and us putting that out there, like in whatever way, I that keeps me out of self and hopefully carries some kind of message. I view that as some kind of service. To have houses like that is amazing.
Yeah, it's fun. I just got to be plumber over there the other day. I had to disassemble the dishwasher and the drain pipe and snake it and fix the freezer. And I was like, all right, you guys, it's all good now. That's the glamorous life of sober living. It's good, but I knew literally at 4 months sober, I knew I wanted my entire life to revolve around recovery. I had no idea what that was going to look like. I just knew I wanted everything I did to be recovery related. So that's what I do. There's nothing.
My podcast, I don't want to ask too many questions, but are you in California now?
No, I'm in Kansas City.
Oh, you're in Kansas City?
Yeah.
Oh, I was just there. I mean, I was there for
Red Kingdom.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. The airport looks great now.
The airport is amazing.
I mean, it used to be like they would say one of the most like unattractive or unappealing.
But it was so easy. Our little tiny airport was just so easy to maneuver. Uh-huh. And you know, I've done interventions for 15 years, right? For 12 years straight, I traveled every week, like fly somewhere, do an intervention, grab that person, fly them to treatment wherever, and then go back either California or Kansas City for, you know, 5 or 6 days. And then I'd be off somewhere doing it again. Yeah. And flying into Kansas City was so nice because it was just small and it was so easy to navigate and it didn't take a huge chunk of your time. You know, it was, it was nice, but I got to fly out of the new airport like the first week that it opened. I went to Mexico and I remember walking in and I'm like, this doesn't even feel like you're in Kansas City. Like, this doesn't even feel like home, you know?
Yeah. Pretty cool.
It is. It's really nice. How do you handle transitions, right? Because like we've talked about your career a little bit. You've done some different things. You've mentioned a couple of different cities, right? I'm not going to go through your whole resume. But obviously you have transitioned in and out of things. And transitions and changes can be challenging for people in sobriety for sure.
Yeah.
How do you handle transitions now? Like if you're moving, like, cause some of these things are big, like you're talking about moving states, changing careers, the whole thing.
Well, I'm staying close to recovery and there's nothing cliche about that. Like I, in sobriety, you know, I got sober. I lived in Jersey City. I was working in a guy's kitchen in New York City. And then I moved to Springfield, Massachusetts. I started to do sports. Then I was in Charlotte again, then Louisiana, but all those places are now back in Texas. Or in Texas, all those places, it didn't happen right away, but I always knew to find my like AA tribe, and so that is just wherever I am, I'm an alcoholic. Like we started this podcast off, and you know, staying close to recovery is how I get through all those transitions. My brother, who's like a big part of this thing, he passed away in May. He lived in Hermosa. He was a therapist out there. And he was sober. He got sober like a year or two before me. And I could remember calling him. I was like uncomfortable. I was in sobriety. I was back in Charlotte. I didn't like my living situation. And, you know, he just told me that flexibility was a huge part of life, right? And being able to remain flexible and while staying on the beam, while staying close to recovery. But like, you know, like when I, even in today's day and age, like when I find myself becoming rigid, like that's because I want things to be easy. Like I really do. Like I don't like surprises because they're hard. You know, now I don't put myself in an environment where I'm going to be hit with a ton of surprises, but every so often something comes around the corner that you have to adjust to. Like, how are things going when they're not going well? You know, and those transitions, things will always pop up that will make you comfortable. And all I have is recovery and sobriety. So like I have to lean on, luckily I've been sober long enough where and the recovery house stuff, going to treatment, you develop a network, and moving around to different cities, you develop different AA groups that you stay close with. So I've got a Rolodex of people that I can call and I'm comfortable calling that keep me grounded and keep me close to the fire. So like the transitions, wherever I've gone, I've stayed close to AA. I'm actually kind of down on myself now. And I'm AA, so like that's 12 steps, you know, sorry. But I stay close.
You can say it. I'm very open. Like I feel like everybody knows what you mean when you say 12 steps. So what's the difference if I say AA or 12 steps, you know?
You know, there's old timers that scared the shit out of us about that stuff. So I'm still,
yes, for sure.
Still a healthy fear.
But now I'm equally scary, so I'm okay with it.
So I think that the staying close to AA during those transitions, that has been just the magic for me. And I have groups everywhere now. Oh, here's what I was going to say. I'm disappointed in myself because I haven't, when I got to Manhattan, Kansas last Friday, I was like, I'm going to go to a meeting. And I looked up a new meeting and the only one was on Zoom. And I was like, oh, okay. So I couldn't get to a meeting, but I used to be really good at that, flexing that muscle where I go to an in-person meeting in different places where I am. And that is magical.
That's magical. I agree. I've gone to meetings everywhere. I've been around the world. I always go to meetings and having that built-in family is incredible. But you know, I'm glad you brought that up being in small town Kansas, right? Because it definitely gives you a taste too of what it's like in different places. Because for me, being back and forth, Kansas City and LA, like LA is a very different beast when it comes to recovery programs than Kansas City. Like their meeting directory is like a freaking phone book.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's insanity. And we have a lot of meetings here, but we don't have it like that for sure. And you get in those smaller communities, especially after COVID, it's just a whole different thing. A lot of meetings, when you're starting from only having 10 or 12 meetings, and then you have a COVID situation, like a lot of the smaller meetings never made it back to in-person.
Yeah.
And in those smaller communities, it's hard.
It's a bummer. Yeah. I mean, it is a bummer. Luckily, being here in Texas, like the meetings are still here, right? Like the ones that I went to, but some of the people aren't. And you know, their own path may be going to Zoom and that's where they're comfortable. Yeah. I just hope they're sober, you know, because it's a total, again, another podcast, but like the pandemic and people, like it just, everybody had their bag of hammers to carry and some people different ways, you know.
The pandemic was definitely really hard on addiction all the way around. You know,
you could answer this better than me. I think it brought more people to their knees and brought more people in, maybe even quicker than they would have ended up. People who I didn't think were alcoholic and actually who were, and they ended up, you know, kind of bottoming out or falling apart or whatever, and for recovery. I learned a lot about people and addiction, and as more people came on board during COVID. And I also think that for me, like, and I think I could say this for you too, like somebody who's got a program and has people that they're close to, I was made for that shit. I mean, I had a couple Zoom meetings I could get to. I was lucky where I still went to work. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. What do? I get on meetings. I talk to other people. I didn't feel disconnected. I kept it rolling, but I totally understand how some people could have felt like they were without a net and it got real hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, especially in smaller communities, I'm in Dallas a lot. I work with a lot of treatment centers in Texas. So Dallas and Austin, I'm there all the time. And both of those places have really incredible recovery communities too. Yeah. They're great places to be sober.
Yeah.
But it is hard. I think the pandemic also sort of lowered the barrier to entry, right? Where people will freak out and stress out about going to an in-person meeting because it feels like you walk in the door and the spotlight's on you and everybody's looking at you and, yeah. and we all have anxiety anyway, you know? And it's like, you're never walking into a meeting because shit's going well. You know what I'm saying? Like you are in the hardest time of your life. You feel yeah. the worst you have ever felt. And you have to walk in this room and face all of these strangers and like say out loud that, you know, you have this problem. So I think being able to do online meetings made it easier for a lot of people, right? At the same time, I think it also created a lot of its own problems because people can kind of wallow in their little tiny pieces of denial for yeah. much longer, you know, and logging onto meetings and leaving their camera off and not sharing and yeah. doing 65 other things while they're half-assed listening. Like yeah. that is a very different experience than like when I got sober, like you show up and you show up every day and that's what you do. And if I pulled my phone out in a meeting, then my sponsor would text me from across the room and say, put your fucking phone away. Yeah. I'd be like, okay, I'll yeah. put it away. You know? Yeah, no,
you gotta chase it. I was attracted to people and I was one of those people who I did, and I'm not trying to set the bar here for any high for anybody else, but I did chase my recovery like I chased my addiction.
100%, yes.
That's how I would go when I had the time. You know, I had the gift of unemployment for a little while, right? Like I would go to four, there were days where I go to four meetings a day, three meetings. I mean, and it really, I built up, I don't know, just what I needed in AA early on.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that takes us full circle back to the top of the show too, in talking about the simplicity of it. The simplicity of it for me when I got sober, I mean, there weren't other options, right? I went to AA because that's where you went. And that was the only thing that was available. I have zero problem with that, right? I walked in the room. I didn't have any hangups. I wasn't weird about it. I really enjoyed it. I felt like I identified with everybody in the room, no matter how different we looked or dressed or cars we drove or whatever. I just identify with every single person that shared. I could identify with something and I loved it there. I could not wait to get there every day, but it just was so simple that it made it attainable for me. Because if it gets too complicated, I'm going to bow out, right? Like I'm going to be the person that's like, ooh, this is too much. It's taking too much thought process. I'm out.
Yeah. 1,000%. You know, getting off the debate squad was one of the best moves I ever made. Like,
yeah. Look,
like my life is broken. It does not work. And this is the best way that I see other people around me that have had the same problem I have, that they've gotten better. And it was promotion by attraction. And I really responded to going to meetings. And like you said, stop comparing myself out.
Right.
Like I'm here, like these are this. And now it's like this is my tribe.
Yes.
I really feel more at home with a bunch of other alcoholics than anywhere else.
Yes. You know? I do not want to be out in the world messing around with non-addicted people too much.
Yeah.
I love being with my people.
And again, this is a whole other thing, but like people who, you know, because not everybody's blessed with the curse that we had, right? Like you know, it is the curse, the blessing and the curse. Like, you know, we could have died, but now it's the, I was said to me by a therapist one time, this is the only disease you can have that if treated correctly, you can be a better person for having.
Right.
I mean, you know, but there's other people who are out there who are just kind of in the wind and they're not, just regular people who aren't seeking, you know, therapy or aren't doing things that they could probably do to make themselves better. And if I'm with somebody else who's crazy like me, even if as long as they're attending to that craziness and they're in complete acknowledgement of it, then I can ride with that person, you yes. know, like, but as long as you're on planet Earth with me, I just appreciate that.
Yeah. Amen. Mm-hmm. And I want to say to everybody listening, because obviously we are 12-step people and we are really singing those praises, but we also said, love all the options, love all the programs. I love that people can get sober 1,000 different ways. And for me, that was a lot of starting a podcast, right? And it's a lot of why I have my own coaching programs and things like that, because there was a moment sitting in the rooms of AA where I just had this thought like, huh, like this isn't the only place to learn this stuff. You know, and I got certified to be a life coach very early in my sobriety. It was something that always fascinated me. Like I've followed Tony Robbins since I was a young teenager, and I just always loved self-help and personal empowerment and all that stuff. And realizing that like a lot of the things I was learning in my own personal development journey mimicked the things I was learning in those rooms. And I was like, okay, so you don't have to sit in these rooms to learn all of this stuff, right? That's just where I learned it first. But you don't have to be in those rooms to learn the stuff and make your life better. Like you can do it all these other ways too, and that's okay too.
Yeah, and that's why I started my podcast, because I wanted to be like, come one, come all, like about recovery. Yeah. Let me hear about like I don't care how you do it.
Right.
I mean, I really don't. I used to sometimes I think I got a little frustrated with people that like would get sober and like wouldn't go to AA or whatever. And I think I maybe have evolved out of that. I don't know if you can use me and evolve too much, but I think I have like graduated beyond like resentments that guy's sober and he doesn't work a program. You know, I'm all good.
Well, I think there's a difference between sobriety and recovery, right? Like I know a lot of people that quit drinking, but they don't recover. Like that's a different thing. You know, I had to quit drinking first, but I had so many wounds to heal. And that's the recovery part, right? Like I wanted to be a better person. And I have one very narcissistic parent. And I was a kid in the 70s, right? Like it's narcissism, misogyny, like you name it. And I had all that stuff that I was taking out in the world too. All those wounds and trauma and all of that stuff. Like I had to heal. That's the recovery part. Like to be a nicer person, to make sure that my narcissistic tendencies didn't get too out of control, right? To have a handle on that stuff, to be a nicer human, you know, it all goes together. But I think there is a difference though in just sober and recovery.
So you must have been tough before all this, but I bet you still are. Yeah.
I was a real treat. Yeah, it was fun. No, but it is. I mean, those are the things that you work on, right? It's like, as we say, character defects, like you have to identify that stuff and you have to want to fix it, but you have to have the humility to identify it and want to fix it and be okay with that.
Like a buddy of mine says in a meeting I go to here, he says, I still have all my character defects. I just don't use them as much.
Right. That's a beautiful way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. It is.
Okay. Final question. Favorite question. What is your favorite thing about being a sober person?
That I can go anywhere that I want to and feel confident and spiritually fit. When I'm spiritually fit, excuse me, I can feel confident and really good about what I'm putting into a situation. And that is beyond my wildest dreams. That I can go to a dinner somewhere, have to be out late. I'm also comfortable with like telling people I'm going home. I was with a guy, we were in last week and we were in Manhattan and we went to dinner and it was after the game and these guys are drinking, I'm not. And you know, it's like 8 o'clock, 8:30, right? And they're like, my buddy goes, yeah, Alex wants to go to somewhere else. It's after dinner. And I looked at him, I said, where the fuck are you going? Like, I'm driving you, like I'm going home. And it was just like, because I was tired, like, there is not one part of me that's like, I got to go because I got to, like, nah, like I'm going home. I don't give a shit what anybody thinks. Like, at least in that moment, I definitely didn't. And, you know, to have that freedom. And also if I want to go out or if I have an obligation where I need to be out somewhere really late, I can do that and do it like a gentleman and not like throw a tantrum. And, you know, sometimes you're not always going to love the situations you're in, but I'm able to do things today that I drank and took drugs to do. And I'm able to do things today that I actually had to drink and take drugs to have the courage to lie about doing. Like, you know, stuff I thought was so unattainable is really, it's everything I have in my life is because of, like you said, sobriety, you know, the sober journey I'm on. And the gift of it is I am able to go off the rails at 9 a.m. in the morning and get back on by 10 a.m. and restart my day. Like, I'm not defined by stupid shit I do now. You know, like, I don't have any shame. I mean, that's not true. I do once in a while, but I can shut that shit down pretty quick now. And
fix it, right? I feel like that makes a huge difference. Like, now if I make a mess, it's okay to make a mess. We're all going to kind of make a mess of things sometimes, right? Yeah. But if I make a mess, I can clean it up.
Yes.
Where before I didn't even have the self-awareness to know I needed to clean it up.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And have the skills to do it, the blueprint to do it, the people to come in and help you do it, and to understand that taking direction is really a big part of my life. And that's fine.
Yeah. I think with the boundaries too, and like leaving and being okay, saying F this, I'm going home, right? Like, age helps with that too. And I don't know how old you are, and I'm not trying to age you, but you did say Rolodex. So I think we can't be too far off, but, you know, but I'm telling you, like, in your 50s, especially, like, it's so much easier to just laugh and like, negative. I'm definitely not doing that. I am going home. I'm old. I'm tired. I'll see you later.
And you don't give a shit. Like, truly don't.
Not at all.
That is one of the best parts about aging too.
Yeah. There's a certain freedom in it. I do miss some of the, like, the recklessness that you can have in your 20s, you know, because your whole life is ahead of you. So you can just make a colossal mess. And it's like, you know, you have plenty of time to clean it all up.
Yeah.
Well, you can make terrible decisions and, you know, it's all good.
I didn't know I was going to make, I would make a mess and then another mess and then another mess. And there was a point in time where I truly did believe that I was running out of time. Like, I didn't know. Light bulb on, like, that time I went to dinner with that guy and he told me I needed to go to rehab. Like, I knew that I was out of moves. I really did. And I knew that, you know, I was either going to die or I was just going to be a complete mess for the rest of my life. Like, there were certain people I could point to and be like, whoa, like, is that going to be me when I'm 60? You know, like, I can't. And I'm sure that was God coming in or higher power or whatever, universe telling me, like, this is your chance.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't have any future plans because I thought I was going to die. I mean, I always just assumed that one night I would go to sleep and I just wouldn't wake up. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was 97 pounds and I drank enough for four people on a daily basis. I did not know anyone that would outdrink me. You know, probably because I was a bartender and I drank every day, like, for so many years. Like, my tolerance just built up for so many years. But I do remember having those, like, conscious thoughts, like, God, like, how much can my body take? You know, like, at some point, I'm just not going to wake up. And yeah. I didn't have any future plans. I never thought about my life. I never thought about doing anything outside of bartending because I didn't think I would live long enough.
Yeah.
You know, that's sad when you think about it now. It's like, wow.
I would just bullshit people on what I was working on when I wasn't working on anything. Right. I have one lie after the other gone.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I ended up in college at 37. I didn't go to college till I was 37 because I was like, I literally woke up one day and I'm like, fuck, what am I doing? Like, dude, I can't be a bartender when I'm 50 and, like, no retirement, no skills. Like, I'm feral. I'm not domesticated, right? So I'm not, like, employable. And I'm okay with being feral, but it's like you have to create some kind of future for yourself. Like, what are you going to do? I don't want to be, you know, God, getting AARP and bartending still, you know, like, it just freaked me out. And I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll go to college. I'd been sober 4 years, I think, by then. And I thought, well, keep bartending. I guess I'll try.
You got sober?
Oh, yeah. Years. For years.
Which, by the way, is part of the freedom of this program.
For sure. It also, I had, you know, hindsight obviously is always 20/20, and you can look back and connect so many dots, you know, in hindsight. And I can see now, like, total freaking higher power moment. The universe was always there planting the seeds, right? So when I was in LA, I mean, half of LA is sober and going to 12 steps. You know what I mean? Like, you can't do anything in California without meeting sober people.
Yes.
So literally everywhere I worked, I always worked next to a bartender that was sober, or one of the cocktail servers was sober. So it wasn't weird to me.
Yeah.
And then I dated a guy when I was 26 or 27. He had been sober 16 years. He owned a coffee shop on Sunset Boulevard that catered to AA and NA people. It was open till 4 a.m. So we were always hanging out there with all the sober people, you know? So I had all these little seeds being planted along the way. So in my head, as a bartender, it was almost like the natural progression to get sober. You know, it's like you have part of your career that you're a drunk, and then the next part of your career, you're a sober person.
Pocket for a while?
Like, did I what?
Kind of have AA in your back pocket. Not that we know when to pull it, but I did. I knew people in my life that had gotten sober, and I did think to myself, there will probably be a time where I stop drinking. That's the only way. I knew that, you know?
Interesting. I can't say that, but it's interesting. My best friend, Andy, he told me years ago, he's like, you know, I remember you saying to me one time when I had to be probably late 20s. He goes, I remember you saying to me one time that you'd live half your life drunk and the next half your life would be sober. And like, yeah. I said that to him in my 20s, apparently. So yeah, it was buried somewhere in there. But I think I had all these little touch points. I didn't necessarily think that I would go. Here's another piece. In California, we have moderation management, right? So, which is kind of everywhere now, if it's still around. But back then, you know, 275 years ago, when I was in my 20s, it was that was my first thought, right? It's like, oh, I'll do moderation management. Yeah. Of course, because you're not going to quit, right? Why would you quit? So I go on the website and I look at it. And it like has this list of these are the things that you have to do like to become a part of this. And the first thing is quit drinking for 30 days. And I was like, well, obviously I can't do that program. Like, I was out instantly. Yeah, it was crazy. So I don't know that I ever really knew I would go to AA until the very end. Like I said, the last couple of years for me were super dark, just really depressing. Overwhelmed with self-hatred, hated my life. I was such a liar. I was just becoming such a disgusting person where I had maintained some semblance of normalcy for a long, long time. But the last couple of years were just really gross, you know, and it was just getting worse, obviously. But I just knew I would have to do something, and AA was just all there was, you know?
Yeah. It wasn't that long ago. Come on. Oh my God.
2000. I got sober in 2006. I just celebrated 18 years. January was 18 for me.
Way to go. How about that?
Crazy.
Yeah.
I know. Now, see, I'm about to be one of the old timers you were talking about.
That's good.
That's why I said now I'm equally scary. Now I'm the scary old timer.
If you're an old timer, that means you're still connected and you're a part of it, which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Well,
kind of just move on. It doesn't mean that they start to drink, but life is long. And if you get sober at, you know, like I got sober at 33 and I plan on dying.
Me
sober.
Too.
I still got a lot of work to do, you know?
Yeah. A lot of life to live.
Yeah, exactly.
Pete, thank you so much for coming on and doing this with me. It's been a pleasure.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Thank you.
You've reached the end of another great episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast. Candid and honest conversation about addiction and recovery. Be sure to visit us at addictionunlimited.com to join the conversation and access show notes and links to everything we talked about. Love this episode? Please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes to help us improve and give you the information you want. Thanks for listening. See you next week.